Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Imagine walking into a brightly lit convention center on a Saturday afternoon.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You've just come from inspecting this pristine, minimalist glass and steel architecture of a brand new retail store.
Right. Very sleek.
Very sleek. And there, sitting right in the middle of a cosmetology and barber convention, is an 8-foot-tall, 20-foot-long inflatable human colon.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. A giant, fleshy, walk-through tunnel of gastrointestinal disease.
That is quite the visual whiplash.
Exactly. And, you know, most people would laugh nervously and just walk away.
Oh, absolutely. I would run away.
Right. But if you're the man we are talking about today, you look at that massive, grotesque medical exhibit. You compare it favorably to your own anatomy, and you decide it is the absolute perfect metaphor for your life.
Which is just so perfectly him.
It really is. Welcome to Ruination, the Early Years. I'm your host, King.
And I'm Gail, your expert guide through this massive, brilliantly chaotic archive.
And today, we are doing a deep dive into a very specific 5-day stretch of the Big Fatty Online universe.
Oh, it's a good one.
It is. We are looking at July 21st through July 25th, 2008.
That's episodes 122 through 126 for those tracking the historical record.
Exactly. And the reason we are zeroing in on this specific week is that it acts as this, like the ultimate stress test for the BFO machine.
That's a great way to put it.
Right.
Right.
Because we are looking at a man trying to balance these incredibly high-minded, rigid artistic pursuits with the most absurd, visceral, bodily reality imaginable.
And to really understand the stakes of this week, you, the listener, have to mentally strip away the big fatty you might know from the later years of the archive.
Yeah, you have to forget the modern era entirely.
Exactly. Erase the image of the relaxed retiree living in the villa, you know, casually logging his 5 to 7 miles a day on his morning walks.
Because in July 2008, that version of him is a full decade away.
Right. The reality of 2008 is just raw survival.
It really is.
He is broadcasting from the basement studio.
The Fat Cave.
Yes, the Fat Cave. And he's still entirely tethered to his soul-crushing corporate day job.
The place he famously calls the coal mine.
Right, and he has been chained to that desk for decades at this point.
So the man on the microphone this week is just bone-tired.
Beyond exhausted.
The tension between the corporate drone he is forced to be from 9 to 5.
Uh-huh.
And the chaotic, unfiltered ringmaster he becomes in the Fat Cave at night is basically the engine powering the entire show.
It's the whole dynamic.
Yeah. We are listening to a man desperately trying to exert control over a life that is fundamentally exhausting him.
And, you know, that exhaustion is immediately apparent right at the top of the week.
Oh, right from Monday?
Yeah. He kicks off Monday, July 21st, completely physically compromised.
Because he and his kitty have just flown back to Charleston from a trip to San Francisco, right?
Exactly. And the jet lag is actively destroying his internal clock.
It's brutal.
It is. And, like, transitioning from Pacific time back to Eastern time might seem like a minor inconvenience to a normal person.
Sure, you're tired for a day.
Right, but for someone whose entire psychological stability relies on producing a rigid 20-minute daily audio dispatch.
It's a disaster.
A disrupted circadian rhythm is a massive logistical threat to him.
So he sits behind the microphone really late at night, his internal clock screaming that it's, you know, 3 hours earlier.
Yeah.
And he openly admits on mic that he is quote-unquote bone weary.
But he hits record anyway.
He does. He tells the audience point blank that the only reason he is recording at that absurd hour in his condition is out of love for his listeners.
And that framing is really telling, I think.
How so?
Well, calling it love kind of masks the underlying compulsion.
Oh, that's true.
The BFO machine demands daily feeding. If he skips a day, the entire structure he's built to keep the chaos at bay starts to crack.
Right. So his physical comfort, like sleep, or recovery from cross-country travel, has to take a backseat to the structural requirement of the broadcast.
Exactly. And he isn't just recovering from a flight.
No, he isn't.
He is stepping right back into a highly volatile, real-world artistic pressure cooker.
It's a community theater production.
Yes. Because, you know, one demanding day job and a daily show isn't enough.
Clearly not.
He is also sitting in the director's chair for a local production of Biloxi Blues,
which is the second installment in Neil Simon's Brighton Beach trilogy.
Right. And he actually references the other two plays on the air, Brighton Beach Memoirs and Broadway Bound.
Making sure the audience understands the artistic pedigree of what he's working on.
Exactly. This isn't just some lighthearted local review. It's a character-heavy, emotionally resonant piece of American theater.
And it requires a highly specific cast, which is where the stress comes in.
Oh, a massive amount of stress.
Because Biloxi Blues takes place in a World War II basic training camp in Mississippi.
Right.
So he is sitting in Charleston, completely exhausted, with the success of his entire production hinging on whether or not he can find six local male actors who can convincingly portray 18 to 20-year-old Army recruits.
And anyone who has ever worked in community theater knows the sheer terror of casting young men.
It's basically impossible.
It is. They are notoriously the hardest demographic to get into an audition room.
So he takes that anxiety straight to the microphone.
Of course he does.
He tells the audience how terrified he was walking into those Sunday night auditions.
Because he has zero control over who walks through those doors.
Right. He can't force local talent to exist out of thin air.
And for a guy who meticulously controls every single second of his 20-minute format.
Yeah. Sitting behind an audition table and just hoping for the best has to be agonizing.
Oh, completely. But the gamble actually pays off for him.
It does. By Monday's callbacks, he reports with this massive, palpable sigh of relief that half a dozen new young men actually showed up.
The crisis is averted.
He has his soldiers.
He does. And the fascinating thing is, the moment the cast is locked in, all that anxiety vanishes.
Right. And it's replaced immediately by his need to establish total control over their physical bodies on the stage.
Yes. Which leads to this incredible on-air monologue where he breaks down the concept of stage blocking for the listeners.
He goes into full professorial mode here.
He really does.
He strips away the magic of the theater, explaining that actors aren't just organically moving around feeling the emotion of the scene.
No, not at all. Every single step, every cross from stage left to stage right.
Every movement upstage or downstage.
Exactly. It is all mathematically plotted out by him, the director.
He spends hours mapping out this physical geography.
And he explains that blocking is primarily about sight lines and structure.
Making sure nobody is standing in front of anyone else.
Right. Ensuring the audience's eye is drawn to the exact right spot at the exact right moment.
But wait, think about the specific quote he drops here, because I really think this is the skeleton key for the entire week.
Oh, I know the one you mean.
He tells his audience that for an actor, it is often more important to be in the right physical place on stage than it is to say the correct line.
Which is wild for a director to admit out loud.
It is. He says if you flub a line, a castmate can jump in, improvise, and cover for you.
But if you stand in the wrong place,
the entire visual architecture of the scene collapses.
He is openly prioritizing rigid physical structure over the actual dialogue.
Yes. The container matters more than the content.
Exactly.
And you see what he's doing here, right?
I do, but break it down for the listeners.
Okay, so think about it. He isn't just talking about Biloxi Blues. Look at the mechanics of his show.
Right.
He has a non-negotiable 20-minute time limit. He has a highly regimented system for listener voicemails.
He dictates exactly how and when his audience is allowed to interact with him.
Exactly. He is treating his listeners exactly like the actors he is blocking on that stage.
The deep dive is just another theater.
Yes, the audience members are his cast.
He is basically giving them stage directions.
Call the voicemail line, but keep it brief. Hit your mark. Stay downstage.
It makes so much sense. When you live in a world where your day job drains you and jet lag ruins your sleep,
you create a 20-minute audio sanctuary where you are the absolute dictator of reality.
And if his audience hits their marks, the show works.
Even if the actual content of the voicemails is messy or chaotic.
It's a brilliant coping mechanism, honestly.
It really is.
He built a rigid box so that the chaos has somewhere safe to happen.
And you really see how much he craves that sleek, perfectly controlled environment when you look at his consumer habits this week.
The transition from the dusty, unpredictable world of community theater to his obsession with Apple products is jarring.
The Apple snack store.
Yes. The level of genuine, unironic enthusiasm he has for the grand opening of the new Apple store in Charleston on Saturday, July 26th, is just staggering.
And he calls it the Apple snack store.
Right. He uses Apple snack as this legal, distinct, affectionate nickname for the brand.
Which is hilarious. And in 2008, you have to remember, the opening of an Apple store wasn't just a retail event.
No, it was a cultural coronation.
He is planning to literally stand in a line outside the mall with his friend, Vader, just to get a promotional, mass-produced corporate t-shirt.
He even dedicates the opening music of his Monday show to the event.
Oh, that's right. He plays a track famously used in the brand's television commercials.
He is fully, completely bought into the aesthetic.
And that aesthetic is built entirely on sleek, frictionless engineering.
Yeah. He talks about the new headphones he bought while he was in San Francisco.
He compares them to the original standard earbuds that came with what he mockingly calls the crank iPod.
The crank iPod. I love that. Meaning the older models with the physical click wheels?
Exactly. And he is mesmerizingly focused on the fact that these new headphones don't have the little L and R printed on them to tell you which ear is which.
Right, because they are designed so perfectly, so intuitively, that they just fit.
They deliver this isolated, rich sound without requiring the user to think at all.
It's pristine.
It's the exact opposite of a messy, unpredictable theater audition.
It is. It's a product that does exactly what it is engineered to do every single time.
He worships that sterile perfection.
And this is where the duality of the archive becomes absolutely brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
The very same man who is obsessing over the acoustic engineering of Intuitive earbuds also spends part of his week wandering around a local cosmetology and barber convention.
And he stumbles upon the ultimate antithesis of sterile Apple technology.
The super colon.
The super colon.
I still can't believe this is a real thing.
An 8-foot tall, 20-foot long, walk-through inflatable replica of a human large intestine.
It is a traveling medical exhibit designed to educate the public about polyps, Crohn's disease, and colorectal cancer.
It is massive, pink, fleshy, and deeply grotesque.
And most people would take one look at a 20-foot inflatable bowel and walk the other way.
But not him. He practically embraces it.
He brings the visual right to the audience with this incredible dead tan delivery.
He notes that this massive cavernous medical display was, quote, slightly smaller than Big Fatty's colon.
It's so funny because he doesn't shy away from the biological reality of it.
No, he transforms this bizarre encounter into a genuine public health PSA wrapped in a joke.
He tells his listeners to eat their fiber to treat their bodies right.
Delivering the immortal line. A happy colon makes everything good.
A happy colon makes everything good. He even debates naming the episode Happy Colon.
Think about the extreme psychological whiplash here, though.
Oh, it's intense.
Hold these two versions of the man in your head at the same time. On Monday, he is worshiping at the altar of the Apple Store.
Glass, steel, binary code, total perfection.
Yes. And by midweek, he is cheerfully narrating a walk through a giant, diseased, inflatable bowel.
It perfectly encapsulates why his audience is so fiercely loyal.
Because he refuses to sanitize his life.
Exactly. In 2008, the internet was rapidly moving toward highly curated, aspirational identities.
People wanted to present themselves as sleek and flawless online.
Right. And he wants the shiny new tech, yes. But he refuses to pretend that he isn't also a middle-aged man dealing with the crude, messy mechanics of human digestion.
He is the ultimate honest consumer.
He really is. He desires perfection, but he lives in reality.
And you see that exact same tension play out in his living room, or more accurately, his basement, when he talks about his shifting reality TV habits.
Oh, right. The Biggest Loser.
He brings up the NBC weight loss competition show.
And he notes a fundamental shift in how he consumes the media.
He tells the audience, with a very real sense of mourning, that he used to watch the show upstairs on his comfortable couch, eating a massive bowl of ice cream.
Which is honestly the most profoundly American way to consume that show.
Oh, completely. Eating ice cream while watching exhausted, overweight people cry on television?
It is the height of detached, comfortable irony.
But he's lost that comfort.
He has. He informs the audience that he has moved his viewing sessions down to the basement.
Because he now watches The Biggest Loser while actively walking on his treadmill.
He's weaponized the show against himself.
He specifically says that watching the trainer, Jillian Michaels, aggressively scream at fat people motivates him to walk faster and push harder.
He is taking the ambient shame of 2008 reality television and turning it into an engine for his own cardiovascular health.
It's actually kind of brilliant.
It is. Yet he admits the experience is hollow without the ice cream.
Of course it is.
He is actively trying to better his physical form, but he deeply resents the loss of the indulgence.
It's that same duality again.
Yeah.
He wants the discipline of the treadmill, but he misses the comfort of the couch.
And he is fully immersed in the reality TV ecosystem.
Yeah, he seamlessly transitions from his own treadmill struggles to dropping casual gossip about Big Brother 10.
Noting that it looks like Steven, the gay cowboy, is about to be evicted from the house.
He treats pop culture as a natural extension of his own neighborhood.
Because he views pop culture as something he actively participates in.
Right, which is exactly why his relationship with the objective facts of that culture is so incredibly combative. Which brings us to a very necessary piece of structural housekeeping.
I think we all know what time it is.
It is time to formally open the segment we call Ruined Ruination.
This is our dedicated space for historical accountability.
Because while he is a masterful storyteller, his commitment to objective reality is notoriously flexible.
Especially when a fact conflicts with his personal aesthetic preferences.
So we have to address two massive, glaring pop culture inaccuracies that he perpetuates during this specific week.
The first one is so frustrating.
It's the summer blockbuster of 2008. The critically acclaimed, universally beloved Pixar animated film about the lonely, trash-compacting robot.
The entire planet knows this movie is called WALL-E.
It is spelled W-A-L-L-E.
The character's name is literally the title of the movie, and the robot says it constantly.
Constantly. But he simply refuses to accept this.
Throughout the week, he stubbornly mispronounces or misidentifies it.
He refers to it as WALL-E.
Completely flattening the distinct phrasing.
And he argues with the premise of the title itself.
It is a breathtaking display of stubbornness.
He looks at a multi-million-dollar Disney marketing campaign and basically decides, no, I prefer my version.
And if you think he is unyielding about a CGI robot, look at the massive, long-running structural prediction he got spectacularly wrong regarding American Idol.
Oh, boy.
For months, during the seventh season of American Idol, he used his daily platform to insist with absolute unwavering certainty that David Archuleta was going to win the entire competition.
He essentially bet his entire pop culture credibility on it.
And, as the historical record clearly shows, David Cook won the season.
It wasn't even particularly close.
No, it wasn't. So why do we dedicate time to highlighting a mispronounced Pixar movie and a botched reality TV prediction from over a decade ago?
What does it actually tell us about the archive?
Well, I think it exposes the psychological core of the entire show.
Yeah.
He operates under a system where his personal aesthetic judgments automatically override objective reality. If he looked at the American Idol stage and decided that David Archuleta fit his specific criteria for a winner, then his prediction wasn't wrong.
Reality was just wrong for not aligning with his script.
Exactly. The director is frustrated that the universe missed its cue.
That's a great way to put it. But the truly fascinating part is how the audience reacts to this.
They don't rebel.
No. They don't write angry emails demanding journalistic integrity.
Because they aren't tuning in for Reuters or the AP Wire.
They don't want a factual recitation of Wikipedia.
They are tuning in specifically for his flawed, stubborn, highly confident distortion of reality.
His inaccuracies actually build intimacy.
They really do. When he mispronounces WALL-E, it ceases to be a massive corporate product and becomes an inside joke between him and the listeners.
His refusal to back down humanizes him.
The flaws are the adhesive that binds the community together.
It's the fat cave reality distortion field.
Yes.
And that reality hits a massive structural milestone this week. Let's look at Thursday, July 24th.
Episode 125.
Hitting 125 daily shows is a legitimate grind, and he recognizes the achievement, though he frames it with his trademark absurdity.
Right, because he realizes that 125 is the number for a quasicentennial.
Watching him intellectually wrestle with the word quasicentennial on a microphone is incredible audio.
He trips over the syllables, repeats it, and finally admits that just thinking about the word makes him, quote, nipply.
It's this hilarious, awkward battle with the English language.
And his suggestions for how to celebrate this grand quasicentennial milestone are equally bizarre.
He suggests they either enjoy quasicentennial cupcakes.
Or, if those aren't available, they should just celebrate with something old and bacon smelling.
Something old and bacon smelling.
It's so specific and so utterly gross.
But he doesn't just leave the celebration at bacon jokes.
No, he delivers a piece of dedicated performance art.
He decides to sing to his audience.
He performs a parody of the classic Broadway song, My Favorite Things.
But he prefaces it by attributing this specific parody version to a performance by the legendary Julie Andrews during her birthday celebration at Radio City Music Hall.
Right. and the lyrics he chooses to sing are a visceral, unflinching catalog of physical decay.
This isn't about raindrops on roses.
Not at all. Listen to the lines he commits to audio. Hot tea and crumpets and corn pads for bunions.
Oh, wow.
No spicy hot food or food cooked with onions.
This becomes a medical chart set to music.
He continues with thin bones and fractures and hair that is thinning.
And finally, we won't mention our short shrunken frames when we remember our favorite things.
That is shockingly dark.
It is. He's taking one of the most beloved uplifting melodies in American theater history and replacing the optimism with orthopedic footwear, gastrointestinal distress, and osteoporosis.
He is using this theatrical performance to process the very real, terrifying indignities of growing older.
He isn't hiding from it at all.
No, he knows his audience is aging right along with him, dealing with the exact same thinning hair and fragile bones.
By turning that shared physical decline into a comedy routine, he creates a space for communal commiseration.
But he can't just sit in the darkness of physical decay.
Right. He immediately balances that terrifying biological reality by escaping into the safest, most impenetrable fortress available to him.
Extreme academic level nostalgia.
This transition is masterfully executed through his weekly cartoon Memory Lane music segment.
The trivia clue he had provided to the audience earlier in the week was incredibly obscure.
He asked them to identify a cartoon character who originated in the funny papers and regularly used the catchphrase, quote, bodacious fire cop.
Bodacious fire cop.
How many adults in 2008 are walking around with that phrase loaded in their immediate recall?
Basically none. It is ridiculously niche.
But he doesn't just reveal the answer and move on. He delivers a collegiate-level lecture on the subject.
He reveals the character is Snuffy Smith, originating from the syndicated newspaper comic strip Barney Google and Snuffy Smith.
He breaks down the character's core identity as a stereotypical moonshine-distilling hillbilly constantly evading the local sheriff.
And then he goes deeper.
He references the live-action feature films produced in 1942 starring Bud Duncan.
Specifically naming Private Snuffy Smith and Hillbilly Blitzkrieg.
He tracks the media lineage from the 1940s all the way to the 1960s King Features syndicate animated cartoons.
He even highlights the specific voice talent, noting that the prolific actor Paul Frees provided the voice for Snuffy Smith in the animated series.
It is an encyclopedic recall of mid-century pop culture.
Look at the emotional whiplash of Thursday's deep dive, though.
Oh, it's intense.
In one breath, he is singing a painful, visceral parody song about his bones literally thinning and his hair falling out.
His physical reality is failing him.
In the very next breath, he retreats into an airtight, academic recitation of a 1942 live-action hillbilly movie and the filmography of Paul Frees.
Nostalgia acts as his armor.
It is the ultimate protective shield.
When the supercolon realities of life, you know, the bunions, the fractures, the sheer exhaustion of aging become too heavy, he retreats into the highly structured, unchanging trivia of his youth.
The past is safe because the past is already blocked and directed.
Exactly. Reciting the history of Snuffy Smith is a way of proving to himself and his audience that even if his body is breaking down, his mind is still razor sharp.
He controls the past because he cannot control the present.
And that desperate need for control bleeds directly into how he manages his audience.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most complex dynamic of the week.
The community chaos, the guilt, and the highly transactional nature of his relationships.
The listener ecosystem of the BFO is intense.
It is demanding, it is deeply weird, and he rules over it like a benevolent, highly irritable dictator.
We see his philosophy perfectly summarized when he talks about his iTunes reviews.
He takes time on the show to explicitly thank a listener named Miss Luna, who had just submitted his 40th five-star review on the Apple iTunes platform.
But he doesn't just say a polite corporate thank you.
No, he uses it as an opportunity to analyze the psychological makeup of his own fan base.
He actively encourages his listeners to go read the reviews, observing that there are some, to use exact words, effed up people leaving very strange but highly appreciated five-star reviews.
He embraces the eccentricity.
He recognizes that a show built on extreme control and bodily humor is going to attract a demographic that feels a little broken, a little outside the mainstream.
He wants that effed up loyalty.
And you hear that loyalty constantly in the voice letters.
The voicemails this week are a chaotic cross-section of humanity.
Take Scotty, for example.
Oh, Scotty. He calls the show shortly after having his gallbladder surgically removed.
The medication and the post-surgical exhaustion are completely altering Scotty's voice.
He points out that it sounds like Scotty is literally falling asleep mid-sentence while recording the voicemail.
And he immediately diffuses the concern with a joke, claiming he just naturally has an effect on men that get around him and immediately fall asleep.
But strip the joke away and look at the raw intimacy of that moment.
It's wild. A listener has a major organ removed from their body, and their immediate hazy post-surgical instinct is to call a show host.
That is a staggering level of parasocial attachment.
These listeners view him as a primary figure in their lives.
We see a different side of that intense attachment with Brian from Boston.
Brian calls in hot.
Very hot. He is fiercely defending himself against the accusation of pod fading,
which is the cardinal sin of slowly abandoning a community.
Brian states that he takes umbrage at the accusation, aggressively insisting that he listens to every single deep dive. Every single day.
And he loves the friction.
He revels in the fact that a listener is taking genuine umbrage and feeling the need to aggressively prove their loyalty.
Because loyalty in this universe is a currency, and it can be exchanged for goods.
Yes, the economy of the show.
We hear from Bill in St. Louis, who calls in and officially triggers a milestone by becoming voice letter number 175.
This isn't just a point of pride. It activates a tangible reward.
He announces that Bill has won an XL BFO t-shirt.
But he delivers the prize with his signature abrasive customer service.
Oh, he really does.
He tells Bill on the air, if it's too small, that's too bad. If it's too big, that's too fiffing bad.
He fulfills the transaction, but he refuses to coddle the winner.
You get the shirt, you don't get a tailor.
He uses positive reinforcement with the t-shirt, but he is equally masterful at using negative reinforcement to control his peers.
The saga of Ryan from the Bielfesch video podcast is a brilliant case study in the weaponization of guilt.
This is Machiavellian network manipulation.
Ryan had recently launched a video show, and in his early segments, he was creating these visual montages featuring his friends, family, and other people in the community.
He even recorded an entire segment wearing cow masks inside a Chick-fil-A.
He had used his much larger platform to heavily promote Ryan's Chick-fil-A stunt.
But when he watched the episodes, he noticed a glaring, unforgivable omission.
He was not featured in any of Ryan's photo montages.
The perceived slight was immense.
He didn't keep it private. He took it directly to the microphone.
He complained loudly to his audience, demanding visibility.
He leveraged his audience against Ryan.
And the pressure campaign worked flawlessly.
Ryan completely caved.
He released a special dedicated episode of his video show designed entirely to appease him.
The title of the appeasement episode alone is a masterpiece of submission.
What was it?
Fat ham, it ain't kosher.
Oh my God.
Ryan compiled approximately 30 different pictures of him and intercut them with images of literal ham and tankard gin.
To complete the tribute, Ryan scored the entire video montage to Fat Weird Al Yankovic's famous parody of the Michael Jackson song Bad.
And he was absolutely delighted.
He played the Weird Al audio on his own show, taking a victory lap.
He openly admitted that he had successfully weaponized Jewish mother-style guilt to force another creator to center him in their narrative.
If you don't hit your mark on his stage, he will guilt you until you do.
This relentless transactional accounting isn't just reserved for the online world either. It governs his literal physical survival.
We see it in his everyday economic philosophy during a highly detailed recounting of a grocery trip.
The grand director of the Fat Cave suddenly becomes the ultimate relatable coupon clipper.
He walks the audience through his supermarket strategy.
He proudly announces that he managed to spend only $27 while walking out with $39 worth of items.
He fixates on that $12 margin.
Saving roughly 30% of his grocery bill is a massive victory against the financial drain of his life.
And he is very specific about where he allocates those saved resources.
He went hunting for double stuffed Oreos.
Specifically the peanut butter and the mint flavored varieties.
But it's not just the flavor that fascinates him. It's the engineering of the packaging.
He spends time praising the new peel-open flap on the front of the Oreo bags.
And to validate his own consumer enthusiasm, he points out that Drew Carey frequently praises the exact same Oreo packaging on The Price is Right.
He is validating his snack food choices through the host of a daytime game show.
It's this incredible matrix of consumerism, pop culture, and thrift.
But the true peak of his transactional interactions this week happens outside the grocery store during his weekend excursion to Patrick's Pub.
This is a story of profound miscommunication.
He is at the pub and he notices a young Mexican man giving him the eye, essentially winking at him from across the room.
The guy eventually walks over to initiate a conversation, but they immediately hit a massive language barrier.
He tells the audience that between the ambient roar of the bar, his own self-admitted hearing issues, and the language differences, he couldn't comprehend a single full sentence the man was saying.
He claims that out of the entire interaction, he only successfully decoded two very specific words: sex and car.
Sex and car, the ultimate blunt force transaction.
He makes sure to clarify for the audience that he did not actually have sex in a car with this young man, but he did accept his phone number.
He learns the boy's name is Ran, which he immediately turns into a crude, deeply inappropriate joke. Ran, like I ran over the border.
He says the joke, immediately recognizes the line he just crossed,
yeah,
and notes on the air that he probably shouldn't have said it.
He jokes about editing it out in post-production, but crucially, he leaves it in.
He leaves the mess right there on the audio file.
And that interaction perfectly encapsulates the way he moves through the world.
Think about how highly transactional his entire ecosystem is.
He meticulously tracks a listener named Miss Kathy from South Dakota as she incorrectly types in Pepsi points on his behalf.
He calculates the exact 30% discount on his mint Oreos.
He demands tribute videos in exchange for his promotion.
He treats human interaction with the exact same metric-driven focus as he does his grocery budget.
Every single interaction is an exchange of value.
You give him a 5-star review, he gives you validation.
You hit voice letter 175, he mails you an XL shirt.
You ignore him in a video, he guilts you until you produce a tribute featuring ham and gin.
He is an accountant of human attention.
And that brings us to the end of this exhaustively detailed 5-day stretch from July 2008.
We have watched him enforce the strict theatrical blocking of Biloxi Blues, embrace the terrifying biological reality of the supercolon,
process his aging through a Julie Andrews parody, and aggressively manage the loyalty of his listener ecosystem.
We've covered the entire map of his psyche this week.
But before we go, I want to leave you with a lingering, provocative thought.
Oh, lay it on us.
Think about the tension we've explored between his need to block and direct everyone around him versus his willingness to laugh at the grotesque reality of the inflatable colon.
He forces his audience and his actors to hit their marks because the unpredictability of life terrifies him.
But he also knows that underneath that control, we are all just messy biology.
So ask yourself this: where in your own life are you exhausting yourself trying to block the people around you?
Where are you desperately trying to hand out scripts and force your friends, family, or coworkers to stand on the exact right mark?
And what would happen if you just stopped directing?
What if you let the chaotic, messy, fleshy reality of the supercolon take over your narrative?
If you drop the script and let people be as flawed and unpredictable as they actually are, would it ruin your life?
Or, like him, would that radical surrender to the mess actually build you a loyal, unshakable community?
It's the ultimate question of how much control we actually need to survive.
That is all the time we have for our analysis today. Remember, you absolutely must tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years.
There is so much more of this archive waiting to be uncovered, and we will be here to break it all down. I have been your expert guide, Gail.
And I have been your host, King. Thank you for exploring this universe with us. Until next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.